It's Wednesday, November 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, a key figure revises his testimony in the Trump impeachment inquiry.
It ultimately became an issue that was squarely focused on dangling these so-called, you know, perks to Ukraine, the White House visit, in return for hard, solid evidence on what was going on with Joe Biden and his son.
Also ahead, what role does foreign money play in U.S. politics? Iran says it will enrich more uranium. Several members of a Mormon family are gunned down in Mexico. We'll visit a cafe that is a symbol of interfaith harmony. And what's the surrogacy capital of the United States? That's all on today's International Edition. A key U.S. diplomat told impeachment investigators targeting President Donald Trump that he came to believe that nearly $400 million in military aid to Ukraine would not be released unless Kiev publicly stated it would launch investigations into Trump's political opponents. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins us in the studio. Catherine, welcome.
You're so welcome.
This is the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, and he has previously testified to the three committees on Capitol Hill that are part of the impeachment inquiry. But he added something in this latest round of testimony.
That's right. So Gordon Sondland came out to House investigators yesterday, Monday, and told them, let them know that he wanted to add some addendums to his testimony, which was already 10 to 12 hours on Capitol Hill when he was up there. He changed his mind a little bit about what he wanted to say regarding the so-called quid pro quo between President Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president regarding that congressionally approved aid. He came back and told those House investigators, yes, there was actually a quid pro quo. I needed to tell you that. And of course, the timing is very interesting here. He, of course, knew that this transcript was going to be released this week. This was his last chance to really set the record straight and get on the public record with what he wanted to say about what had happened here.
And I understand that he later talked to President Trump in September, and the president was vehemently denying that he wanted any quid pro quo. It's like, that's not what I meant. That's not what I said. I don't want any quid pro quo.
Right. So Sondland told House investigators that he knew that he really only had one chance with Trump and that he needed to get in and get this issue settled. And that's when Trump came back and talked to him in a very abrupt sounding phone call and said, there is no quid pro quo. That's not what happened here. That's not what I want. I'm worried about addressing corruption. And then Sondland says that the president didn't quite hang up with him, but just very quickly ended the phone call right there.
And there has been some indication that the president was kind of, I don't want to use the word dangling, but that a visit to the White House and special other perks for Ukraine's president would be contingent upon Ukraine publicly stating that they were investigating specifically former Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter and the gas company that Hunter worked for, as well as a now debunked conspiracy theory that Ukraine had interfered in the 2016 election.
Right. So what the two transcripts released Tuesday paint a picture of is something of an escalation in the way these events played out. Sondland describes it all starting out with Rudy Giuliani beginning to get involved, talk of addressing corruption, these calls to, you know, drain the swamp overseas in terms of U.S. aid to other countries, to look to Europe to pay their fair share to Ukraine. Then it kind of escalates, then it shifts, then it changes into something a little bit more domestic, where Trump is starting to ask Ukraine to look into some of these issues and corruption that also happened to involve Joe Biden and his son. And then Sondland says it ultimately became an issue that was squarely focused on dangling these so-called, you know, perks to Ukraine, the White House visit, in return for hard, solid evidence on what was going on with Joe Biden and his son.
Also, I understand the investigators on these committees want to talk to acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney about what he knew. Now, if you people have been keeping up with this story, Mulvaney, about a week and a half ago, came out and did a press briefing where he said, you know, that happens in politics. It's basically, so what?
Right.
And now he's being called by the investigating committees. Do you think Mulvaney is going to go, or do you think that he's going to be like some of the other officials at the White House, going to court to try to not go?
I don't think there's much of a chance that we'll see the acting White House chief of staff coming before these House investigators, given what we've heard from the White House so far, given the non-cooperation with some of the court orders coming from House Democrats. The chances of seeing Mulvaney coming up to Capitol Hill are very, very small. And I want to emphasize that after he came out at that White House press conference and said, of course, there was a quid pro quo, he had a very interesting half day following where he kind of walked back and said there was a denial and he had never meant to say that. And, you know, really in really muddied Republicans' message by that whole half day of the news cycle when he kind of had to get his message straight on what exactly was going on there.
All right. That's VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson, who is keeping up on all things impeachment. Thank you very much, Catherine.
You're so welcome.
And you can find Catherine's reports and more on the impeachment inquiry on our webpage, voanews.com. Some of the headlines in the world. House impeachment panel asks why Mulvaney will not testify. Trump, time for Mexico, U.S. to wage war against drug cartels. Turkey says it captured sister of slain IS leader Baghdadi. Key Islamic State affiliate appears to back new leader, and Al-Shabaab chief partially seen on video for the first time. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Thanks for being with us. Recent headlines have highlighted ways in which foreign donations can enter America's political system, but advocacy groups say stopping the flow of foreign money has been hampered by legal loopholes, illicit financial maneuvers, and ultimately a lack of political resolve. VOA's Brian Padden reports that Republicans and Democrats both strongly oppose foreign interference in American elections, but both parties have also reportedly received foreign donations.
Untold amounts of foreign money are secretly flowing into America's political bloodstream.
The danger to democracy of foreign money in U.S. elections is that it's really a fundamental attack on American democracy and in self-governance.
Recently, prosecutors charged associates of President Donald Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, with funneling $1 million in foreign money from an unidentified Russian businessman to U.S. candidates. The criminal charges arose amid a congressional impeachment inquiry of the president for allegedly pressuring Ukraine to investigate Trump's political rival, Joe Biden. Two of the men, Ukrainian-born Lev Parnas and Belarus-born Igor Fruman, allegedly worked with Giuliani on this effort to pressure Ukraine as well. Meanwhile, an American political operative pled guilty to illegally funneling money from a Saudi tycoon to President Barack Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. To stem the flow of foreign money, transparency advocates are calling for an end to legal but hidden donations to political action groups like the National Rifle Association. The NRA admitted last year it accepted donations from Russia, but said they only use domestic funds in U.S. election spending.
The more of this information that's sort of hidden behind closed doors, the less accountability we're going to have in U.S. politics, and the greater the opportunities become for foreign money and foreign influence to sneak in and affect U.S. elections.
But forcing the disclosure of donors to groups that advocate politically would do more harm than good, say privacy defenders.
We have documented evidence of people, you know, being fired from their jobs, or companies not really wanting to fire them, but feeling they had to because they were being boycotted or harassed. We have evidence of people being, in some cases, physically attacked.
The 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision that unleashed unlimited spending by nonprofit organizations divides transparency and privacy advocates. But both sides agree more could be done to crack down on foreign nationals illicitly channeling contributions through American shell companies and other means. Brian Padden, VOA News, Washington.
Iranian media video on Tuesday purported to show equipment upgrades at some of the country's nuclear facilities and it may further erode Iran's deal with world powers, and came as the U.S. slapped new sanctions on individuals linked to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Matthew LaRotunda of Reuters has more.
Iran appears to be walking further away from its 2015 nuclear agreement with world powers. On Tuesday, President Hassan Rouhani announced that it will start injecting gas into the centrifuges at one of its nuclear facilities. The gas accelerates the process of making high-grade nuclear material from uranium. A day earlier, Iran said it would also replace some centrifuges with newer models, claimed to work 50 times faster. Local media video is said to show the new equipment installed. The news fell on the 50th anniversary of the 1979 Iran hostage crisis, the hostile takeover of the old U.S. embassy. These people were chanting "Death to America" near the site now. The news also fell as the U.S. dropped yet another round of sanctions on Iran, this time targeting individuals close to its Ayatollah, Ali Khamenei. Iran has long demanded that the remaining signatories of the nuclear agreement, that is, European powers, Russia and China, protect his country from sanctions. Rouhani says if the Europeans hold up their end of the bargain, the treaty can be salvaged. President Donald Trump pulled the United States out of the treaty last year.
That's Reuters correspondent Matthew LaRotunda. At the United Nations, Stéphane Dujarric, the spokesman for Secretary General Antonio Guterres, repeated the UN's call for all parties to the so-called Iran nuclear deal to continue abiding by it.
We've seen, we've obviously seen the Secretary General is aware of the announcement made by the President of Iran regarding centrifuges. The Secretary General has consistently reiterated that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action represents a major achievement in nuclear nonproliferation and diplomacy, and has contributed to regional and international peace and security. He reiterates his call to JCPOA participants to abide fully by their respective commitments under the agreement, and all other member states to continue to support the agreement.
A senior Trump administration official called Iran's move a big step in the wrong direction and urged the international community to condemn Iran's escalatory steps. The U.S. official said Tehran is attempting to get the worried European signatories of the nuclear deal to make concessions to Iran. Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador says that his country will act to make sure that justice is done after at least three women and six children, all apparently U.S. citizens, were killed by drug cartel gunmen in northern Mexico. Six children were found alive, one child had a bullet wound, and one remained missing. Mexico said police, soldiers, and the National Guard were searching the rural mountainous area of the Sonora-Chihuahua border for the missing child. President Donald Trump said that it was time to wage war against the cartels and offered U.S. military help to the Mexican government, but President López Obrador said that the use of force would not solve the problem.
Claro que, quisiéramos que
he said, of course, we wish that this had not happened, but we do not think that by riddling with bullets, slaughtering with the use of force, with blood and fire by Mexican security forces against gang violence, that the problem will be resolved. The group of victims, all apparently members of an offshoot of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was attacked while traveling in a convoy of SUVs. Mexico's security secretary said the gunmen might have mistaken the group's large vehicles for those of rival gangs. Utah Senator Mitt Romney, himself a leader in the Mormon Church in the United States, said he agrees with President Trump that more action is needed against the powerful drug cartels in Mexico.
Obviously, it's a great tragedy when any citizens, Mexican or American, in this case American citizens, are brutally murdered. And it's moms and children. This is really unthinkable. And, you know, I agree with the president when he says Mexico has to really knuckle down and go after some of these cartels and stop this escalating level of violence, and hope that if there's a way we can help in that effort, that we're called upon to do so.
South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, the chairman of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, said the drug cartels should be considered terrorist organizations.
There are parts of Mexico that I'd rather go to Syria than Mexico. There are some places over there that are just completely lawless. And I don't know if these cartels are listed as terrorist organizations within our law, but after yesterday, they should be. So I'm having my staff check whether or not Mexican cartels are terrorist organizations within the confines of the U.S. law. If they're not, I'd like to make them. And I stand behind the president wanting to wage war on these people, because what they've done is created threats along our border.
Mexico's security secretary said the Sinaloa cartel had an important presence on the Sonora side, but added that a rival cartel was trying to invade the territory from Chihuahua. A relative said the victims lived in the hamlet of La Mora in Sonora State, a decades-old settlement founded as part of an offshoot of the Mormon Church. Many of the church's members were born in Mexico and thus have dual citizenship. Coming up, we'll hear how virtual reality is helping stroke victims regain mobility. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that every year more than 795,000 people in the United States have a stroke. Now, some researchers at the University of Southern California's Keck School of Medicine are trying to help those with limited mobility because of a stroke to regain some of the motion that physical therapy cannot help them get back. As VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports, researchers are using virtual reality to help people regain movement.
David Karchem remembers exactly when his life changed forever.
It was actually 10 years, 3 months, and 3 days ago.
That's when Karchem experienced a stroke while driving. He was able to pull over and get help, but the left side of his body was paralyzed. While traditional physical therapy helped a little initially, brain-computer interface and virtual reality are helping him regain movement more than 10 years after his stroke.
If somebody can't move their arm in the real world, we can augment that in the virtual world and take their body's attempt to move and make it seem like they're moving in the virtual world.
Occupational therapist and neuroscientist Sukli Liu says when someone has a stroke, there is a blockage in the brain that cuts off blood flow. But virtual reality through brain-computer interface may help encourage the brain to find new routes and bypass the blockage. In this study, electrodes are placed on the scalp and on the arm muscles. They're connected to the computer and this virtual world. The user has to try to move this virtual arm with their real arm or with their mind.
We hope that showing them a virtual arm that moves, that maybe they can feel like is a little bit of their own body, that helps to reinforce and kind of reward the motor attempt. And then it should strengthen the brain activity related to controlling motor abilities.
Karchem says working with a virtual arm has helped him extend his arm and move his wrist and fingers.
It's improved my walking ability.
But Karcham says the positive effects of a session like this only last for a few months. Researchers are working on a more portable version of this technology for participants to take home and continue studying how brain-computer interface and VR can help stroke patients gain a better quality of life. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
There's a bakery located in a suburb of Long Island, New York, that is being held up as a symbol of interfaith harmony by the local population and media. VOA's Anshuman Apte visited the bakery and talked to its Pakistani-American owner to find out why people of different faiths are attracted to it.
When the previous owner of Beach Bakery Grand Cafe decided to sell it a few years ago, the news concerned residents of West Hampton Beach, home to area's large Jewish population. After all, the bakery had been serving their dietary needs for almost three decades.
Since my family is kosher, we appreciated that because there's no other kosher place in the area.
The Jewish community was concerned if the new owner would keep kosher or abide by Jewish dietary restrictions. But Rashid Suleri, who bought Beach Bakery Grand Cafe in 2018, met with community members and assured them he would do just that.
I gave a speech in the local synagogue. About 800 of their members listened to what I had to say. It was also being broadcast live to almost 4.1 million other viewers. We have their certificate, and anybody can come and see if we are kosher or not.
While Rashid kept the bakery kosher by adhering to kashrut, the Jewish dietary laws, he also ensured that the food preparation met the halal standards as per his own Muslim faith.
Kosher or halal?
The main difference between kosher and halal food comes from the way meat is handled and prepared. So we decided to get rid of meat from our menu. So when you are not serving meat, the dairy and vegetarian products, if they meet the kosher requirement, they are automatically halal. The other challenging thing was the alcoholic drinks. So we decided to get rid of them too.
After the changes, along with its large Jewish customer base, the area's Muslim community started visiting the bakery in large numbers.
When my kids heard about this place, we felt that we should all pay a visit.
Most of the stuff that's here, you can't find it in a lot of the places.
It shows the open-mindedness of this community.
They meet each other and have conversations. They try to understand each other. And that's why the bakery is well-regarded in this community.
With its kosher and halal food, the Beach Bakery Grand Cafe has become an example of religious integration in West Hampton Beach area. But for owner Rashid Suleri, like any other popular eatery, the mouth-watering food is the best reason to visit his cafe. Anshuman Apte, VOA News, West Hampton Beach, New York.
A new film from three-time Emmy Award-winning producer Beth Aala, Made in Boise, follows four women who have decided to carry babies for parents who can't. In an unlikely place to be the surrogacy capital of the United States, Boise, Idaho. One of the women, Nicole Williamson, became a surrogate after having her own children and now runs Idaho's largest surrogacy agency.
I carried for two women my first time.
And then my second, Jack, he just turned three. They said they chose me because I listened to Bob Marley. And they wanted their child to hear Bob Marley while I was pregnant and experience that. Ariella just turned one in February.
And then this one will come September 28th. We already have the date set and everything.
My colleague Lori London spoke with producer Beth Aala about Made in Boise.
How did you find out and how did this come to be, that this was where people go to for surrogacy?
So my childhood friend is a labor and delivery nurse at the local hospital at St. Luke's. Mm-hmm. And she told me that a bunch of her colleagues were surrogates for other families and, you know, nurses, lab techs, lots of staff. And so I wondered to myself, well, that's interesting. What do you mean? And as we continued our conversation, I learned that there was this whole community there that I had no idea about. And I think it really was this perfect storm why it was booming in Boise. One, it's much more affordable than places like California, significantly less in cost. There are lots of women who are willing to do this for other families. And St. Luke's Hospital has this incredible program. I mean, they were getting all these surrogates coming through the hospital, and they said, we need to figure out a way to care for these families that are coming through here. And so they developed and implemented the largest and best surrogacy program of its kind in the United States. So it was this perfect storm of all these things happening. And I think also word of mouth, like there, you know, Nicole Williamson, who's in my film, she runs an agency that's the largest agency in Boise. And I think people were just really excited about the care that she gave them and was really hands-on. And so word of mouth really kind of helped too.
So people literally, do you have any statistics as far as this goes, as far as the numbers versus the rest of the country?
Yeah, I mean, in 2018, there were over 100 surrogate births that went through St. Luke's, which, you know, in comparison to three years prior, it was like 30-something. So it really, you know, tripled in just, you know, a few years. You know, and you have to remember, this is a very small city. So if you look at the number of mothers or women who gave birth in Boise, Idaho, versus the amount of women who are actually caring for other people, the ratio is quite high.
When you ask why do we have so many surrogates that live here in Boise, I think there's a couple of factors. One of them is that we have a relatively healthy population of women. I think the other one is that we have a large LDS or Mormon population and a large Catholic populations, and both of those faiths are used to large families. And so it's not outside the norm for them to say, well, I think I could do that for someone and help them grow that way.
What sorts of people are seeking out surrogates?
There's, you know, infertility is on the rise. So there are, you know, all kinds of families. So there are women who, you know, have the embryos, have the eggs, but can't carry. Or, you know, so one of the couples in my film, it's a heterosexual couple, and they went through many rounds of IVF, and they had a really kind of painful, you know, journey in trying to start their family. And then 75% of the families coming to Boise are international families and are gay men. So that's really fascinating, that it's become a hub for single and gay couples, gay men that are wanting to have children, biological children.
And the film profiles four women who are surrogates? And
yes.
And what does this sort of take you through their journey into surrogacy and how they decided to do that?
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, I really was interested in doing this from the point of view of the women and why they're choosing to do this for strangers. And so it really takes their perspective and their experience, the emotional highs and lows, and certainly the physical ramifications that they experience doing this. You know, they have been pregnant multiple times. They all vary in age. And so I really kind of wanted to have a spectrum of women who chose this path to help another family and why they were doing it. And then, you know, of course, you can't really tell their story without telling the story of the people they're caring for. So we also include the families and why they have also chosen surrogacy to start their families. Like, and it's usually like a last resort for all of them, you know? And then we also capture the relationship that develops with the surrogate and the parents, you know, when they embark on something like this, which is very surprising. It gets really emotional and really intimate, and it starts off as like a very formal agreement and turns into something else by the end of the film. She's not heavy,
she's your little. Made in Boise is available online through PBS streaming until November 10th. You can see it by visiting pbs.org. You can find them using the Twitter hashtag Made in Boise PBS. You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us online at voanews.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your day.